Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NABTrade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. One of the more controversial recent debates for investors revolves around the rebate of franking credits, particularly for those in pension phase in a self-managed super fund. I've been getting an increasing number of questions about this, and my guest definitely has. Ordinarily, we wouldn't comment on a policy issue, particularly when the proposed changes are not government policy, they're actually opposition policy, and there's not an election for another 6 months. But the ongoing questions have prompted me to invite Peter Hogan of the SMSF Association to join me today to explain partly how the current system actually works, because there seems to be a bit of confusion for some people, and to outline what any proposed changes might mean. Peter is an SMSF expert par excellence, having been one of the founders of the SMSF Association, and he consults widely with government and policymakers on topics such as the ones that we'll discuss today. Peter, thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure, Gemma. Good to see you again.
You too. People can't see us, which is always a good thing. Firstly, Peter, can you talk us through how franking credits actually work?
Sure. It is, as I think a lot of people have realised, a fairly complicated system. But it's one where it starts off with the company earning profits and paying tax at their appropriate corporate tax rate. That amount of tax that they pay on their income is a credit against their franking, what's called a franking account. Then as they pay dividends out to their shareholders, then that credit is attached to the dividends which are paid out to the shareholders. Now, a company is not allowed to choose the level of franking that they make on the dividends. So if they have the credit sitting there in this franking account, they must fully frank the dividends. And that's why most Australian companies, when they pay a dividend, have a full, generally 30% credit attached to the dividend. But it is a credit, so it's not actual cash. Mm. That's the other thing. So you have a dividend of $70 maybe, and then a franking credit of roughly $30 attached to it. What gets included in your income though is not $70, it's actually $100. And that's what is often overlooked in a lot of the discussion that's been going on in the media at the moment, is that the franking credit, while it's not cash, is nevertheless income that you must include in your assessable income. And that will become important a little later on. As consequences of that. So that's included in income. And then a franking credit is also, as the name suggests, a credit. So that the people who receive that dividend of $70 in cash and $30 credit, $100, then has to pay tax on that $100. So part of the credit offsets the tax on the $100 dividend, but depending upon their marginal rate of tax, they may actually have a little bit of credit left over, which can be offset against tax on other income. Or they may, if their marginal rate is more than 30%, then they'll have to pay a bit of extra tax, but not the full marginal rate of 47 cents in the dollar, just the difference between 30% and whatever their marginal tax rate is, maybe 47% with Medicare. So it's a recognition, I guess, that the company's paying tax and that the shareholders, when they receive those profits, don't pay tax on those dividends and those profits again when they receive them as a dividend. And so that's the idea behind it all.
It seems logical, but it is quite complex in how it works. The system was actually designed by Paul Keating back in the day.
It was, yep.
And the original inception of it was only that you received a credit to the amount that you paid tax.
Yes, it was a use it or lose it system.
Yes.
That's the way it used to be described. So yes. If in a year that you didn't have enough tax liability to soak up all your franking credits, that was tough luck. You missed out, the excess was just lost. As it is in the tax system for a lot of other credits.
For pretty much everything else, absolutely.
Franking, foreign tax credits and things like that, for example. So it was consistent with the tax rules at the time it was introduced. I think the other interesting thing, though, was that it was quite controversial at the time it was introduced.
It's not common around the world.
No, it's very uncommon. And it has driven a lot of company behaviour, dividend behaviour, since it's been introduced as well, which has been quite interesting in that it's been one of the factors, along with the growth in superannuation, which has really had an enormous influence on the Australian share market and the way it's developed since the 80s. going forward. When superannuation, compulsory superannuation was introduced about the same time the franking system was introduced by Paul Keating, both by Paul Keating and associated individuals. And so it has driven a particular style of growth in the market and a dividend policy, which is very, very different in Australia to other countries. The US, for example, companies in the US tend not to pay big dividends. And there's not a demand from the shareholders to pay dividends either.
No, so they're much expectation of it.
No, yeah. They're much happy to have the profits rolled up into the share price and retained inside the company so the share price is boosted. And that's a lot of people scratch their heads and sort of say, well, how is it the US market has risen so much more dramatically than the Australian market since the GFC, for example? And that's one of the factors that the Australian companies are paying out these dividends. So that instead of retaining profits in the company, they're paying them out to shareholders as franked dividends, which is the expectation of many Australian shareholders.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And there is a question mark over whether or not Australian companies are doing themselves a disservice, for want of a better term, by not reinvesting for growth because they're paying out so much to shareholders. Which is not the purpose of the conversation today, but it's worth thinking about.
Yes, that's right. And you know, I mean, I guess companies in Australia have that pressure to pay out as much as they can, but of course they still have to retain some of that profit inside their company to actually then, you know,
to
as you say,
to
grow
and
reinvest in the business as well. Yes. Yeah.
So the system changed in the early 2000s, and this is the issue at hand at the moment that people are concerned about. So early 2000s under the Howard government, the use it or lose it system changed. Can you talk us through how it changed, what it means, what people expect now?
Sure. So basically, as part of one of the budgets, federal budgets in the early 2000s, 2002, 2003, I can't remember now exactly which year it was, but certainly then, around about that time, the government decided that they would actually refund or allow the refund of unused franking credits for two taxpayers, which were individuals and trustees of superannuation funds. So the system for companies was still the same. So on the flip side, the one thing I didn't mention with companies is if they receive a franked dividend, so if a company is actually a shareholder in another company and they receive a franked dividend, then that franking credit is automatically a credit against the receiving company's franking account as well. So they can then frank the dividends that they pass on to their shareholders. So that's going to stay the same under this proposal was put forward and was has always been the case as long as the system has been around, and that will continue on that aspect of it. So basically, so that's why companies were left alone. So their rules didn't change in the early 2000s. So it was individual investors and trustees of superannuation funds, which basically were the two taxpayers which the government of the day said, listen, we will allow you to the extent to which you have excess franking credits left over. We will pay you as a cash refund from the government to you the difference of the amount of unused franking credit that you have. The rationale for that was simply to sort of say, listen, this is a one tax only system, but as a shareholder, you should only pay tax at marginal rates on your dividends and no more than that on the dividends you receive from the company. So rather than having a company profits are taxed at a flat 30% regardless of who the dividends are paid to. This system tried to acknowledge, well, no, it should be the end user's marginal rate of tax should be the appropriate rate of tax for this profits to be taxed at. Hence, if your marginal rate of tax was less than 30%, you got a refund. In other words, you only paid tax on the dividend at effectively your marginal rate of tax.
So this is where things get interesting now. What is the proposed change under the Labor government?
Well, what Labor has proposed...
So worth noting, sorry, before we get started, worth noting, Labor is in opposition at the moment. They're not the current government.
They are indeed.
It's a bit of a tricky scenario in that the current federal government is now a minority government, and so they're not having a lot of fun trying to pass any legislation either. So you've got both sides of government really having to work very hard if they want to get anything passed. But there's almost no chance that an opposition party is going to get legislation passed until they are able to form government.
Until they're in government, yes, indeed. So that's right. So the first point to make is, and it's an interesting point because the announcement was made by a party in opposition at the moment.
Was it prior to the previous election as well? I think feel like they've had this policy for a while.
It's been around for probably I know their
negative gearing. Yeah, their negative gearing policy was before the last election.
Yes, yes, indeed, it has been. This is one that they're taking to this election. Mm. So what they essentially announced was a policy they intend to take to the next election, whenever that was at that point in time. Well, we still don't have a firm date yet at this point in time. But certainly it was some time out before there was an expectation of an election when the Labor Party announced this particular policy. They did actually make, so it was March this year, basically, they came out with that, because that was about the time they then came out with a pensioner carve-out that they announced, which was 28 March, I think, this year. So essentially, they said, if we are elected, we will take this policy to the election. If we're elected, we will then implement this particular policy. The first point to note, as you said, was that they, when they announced that they were in the government, yet anecdotally, a lot of trustees, SMSF trustees that we spoke to, thought that it was announced, therefore it was law, and they started addressing their portfolio construction and asset class allocation and so on as a result of the fact that they believed it was actually law. They didn't understand the parliamentary process at all and thought that any politician who announced a policy, then it became law and then it applied. So, so the first important point to make is, of course, that's not the case.
Yes.
And as you pointed out, we've got to get some legislation introduced into Parliament and get through both Houses of Parliament, receive royal assent before we have actually a law which can be enforced. The other interesting point to make is that, to go back, just to say, to start off with, so what did they announce? Let's do that first. They basically said that they would remove the right of individual taxpayers and trustees of superannuation funds broadly, self-managed super fund trustees or large superannuation funds, regardless, the ability to claim a cash refund for any unused franking credits. In other words, they'll reinstate the use it or lose it system, essentially, that was originally announced when it was originally implemented. Yeah, in the 80s. So that was their initial position. So just as importantly as trustees of superannuation funds have impacted upon this, a lot of people in the retirement age group, or close to retirement or in retirement age group, a lot of the older people in that age group who don't have superannuation but have share portfolios that they use as their retirement savings.
Yes.
So they don't necessarily use superannuation because they're too old to have been in this in the system where they've actually contributed to superannuation. But nevertheless, they've constructed share portfolios and they live off the dividend income and have come to rely over the last 10 or so years or longer, 15 years, the refund of the franking credits as part of the return or the yield that they receive by investing in the share market. And so for some of those people, as well as trustees of superannuation funds, they are potentially adversely affected by the changes should they come in the sense that their cash flow will be reduced because they won't be getting that refund from the government, unless they could change their portfolio around. But a refund, if it's used, is a cash refund is not replaced by simply generating assessable income and using a credit to offset tax. You're still nets.
Yeah.
You're no better off doing it that way. Now. You're using up the franking credit, but you're not getting that cash refund from the government that you would have got before. So the cash flow situation is not going to be any better if you generate
more accessible
income from other sources to soak them up, because you're still in the same net position from a cash flow point of view. And that's something, again, that's perhaps not been widely discussed when people start talking about how particularly trustees of self-managed super funds and smaller investors might respond to these changes should they come in as well. That there's many things that people can do. But the bottom line is they still might have that cash shortfall in many instances. So
you mentioned a pensioner carve-out.
Yes.
That was obviously a change to the original policy. What does
Yes, it
was.
So the opposition acknowledged that perhaps some of the some people who were have lower incomes, so their marginal rate of tax is quite low, are also not particularly wealthy, would be relying on a government pension of some description as well, and would be perhaps proportionally more adversely affected by these changes than someone with much larger amounts of income who perhaps weren't entitled to pensions because their assets outside their home and so on were quite substantial, be it superannuation or direct investments as well. So the opposition sort of said, as of a particular date, if you are receiving an age pension, as of this particular date, which is March this year, then we'll exempt you from this as well. And if you're a member of the self-managed superannuation fund, then that might also impact upon the self-managed super fund, depending upon who are the other members of the self-managed super fund as well. But generally they sort of said, okay, we acknowledge that there are sort of people at the lower end of the economic scale that perhaps would be inappropriately affected by this. So again, like all cut-off dates, and one can understand why they do that, because otherwise people manipulate their circumstances to fit into an exception. So they tend to sort of say, as of a particular date, these people are in. But of course that also creates a divide, because two people in exactly the same situation but started their age pension on either side of that date will be treated very differently, even though they are in the same economic circumstance, which is always a problem with having a hard date to announce. And my personal view is, it is interesting, I'm not aware of an opposition party making an announcement that says, I've got a particular date, these are the rules, and it's going to be, it might be a year or so before they then get into government, and then might be another 6 or 8 months before they get legislation passed. And so they're making something retrospective back to a point in time when they weren't even in government, and whether that is even constitutionally possible. And I'm not a constitution expert, but I wonder whether that's even legally a possibility. And we may end up with a later introduction date, should Labor Party, as we've discussed, be successfully elected into government and then get it through the parliamentary process.
So that was the next question I was going to ask, because I want to be really clear with people about this. You and I've worked in the technical side of things for a long time, you much longer than me, and so you've seen more crazy things than I have, but it's worth noting that timeframes do matter and things can change dramatically from policy to implementation, if they're implemented at all. So let's talk about what it would take and how long it would probably take for this to become law and therefore affect you personally, if you are likely to be affected.
It is a long process. Typically, a piece of legislation from the date of announcement to implementation, particularly tax law, can take up to 2 years.
Right.
In that process, from when it's announced through to, depending on what it is.
Process.
That's right. And so some announcements which are made as part of the federal budget process appear to be implemented much quicker, but that's often because the legislation has been prepared prior to the budget. So there's a lead time and a preparation time coming in, and then an announcement is made at budget night. A lot of work has already been done. So typically, if a government was to sort of say, as of a particular date, we've decided outside the budgetary process, we're going to change the tax law, then it can take up to 2 years for that process to go through, because it has to go back to cabinet, it has to be, the wording has, the broad policy has to be approved and so on, and then that process then has to be drafted, and it goes backwards and forwards in the drafting process until the legislation actually achieves what everyone wants it to achieve, hopefully. Anomalies are identified and all that sort of, that's quite a detailed process. The tax law is quite a complicated beast in itself.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And to introduce a new piece of legislation into the tax legislation, which then you've got to go through the whole Tax Act, which is rather thick, and make sure that all the knock-on effects of this
consequences
and so on. So it can be a long and complicated process, even for something that looks as quarantined as this in terms of its topic. Can have quite a wide-ranging impact across a number of different areas of the tax law. Because, as I said, just the fact that it's assessable income, for example, means that it's the income of a recipient. Now, the Labor Party may or may not decide they want to, if you lose the franking credit or the ability to refund the franking credit, whether that's still going to remain income, because that will impact upon your entitlements to certain low-income rebates and other things within the tax system. Which might seem a little unfair. You're receiving this non-cash credit and suddenly you lose other tax entitlements as a consequence of that, because it pushes your income too high, even though you haven't got the benefit of that credit, for example. So there might be some work around all those sort of things to adjust for those people who lose the opportunity to claim that and use that franking credit, perhaps. But there, as an example of how, the legislation... A change in legislation can have a much wider impact than just the small area in which it deals with.
There's plenty of good examples of when policy has been announced and subsequently amended. And so, I mean, it's been 11 years since we've had a government that's had a majority in the House of Reps and the Senate. So that was the Howard government had both. And so if they announced something, they could get it done relatively efficiently. And it was an interesting time to be watching the implementation of law because they could get stuff done relatively quickly. They didn't have to negotiate. So one of the things that's worth noting is if there is no majority in the Senate, then you've got to negotiate with the crossbench and all of these other things. So a lot of changes tend to happen in that negotiation process. That's where you observe, I think, the most interesting dynamic. You've got to go and find all of the constituents who are likely to support your policy and then ensure that they get what they need to get it through. Better Super when it was first? No, Simpler Super. Do you remember? Was it Simpler Super? Yep, so that was announced in May 2006, which was an enormous change to the superannuation system. Huge, dramatic changes. And it was part of what introduced tax-free super over the age of 60 and all of these other things. One of the things that they introduced was the cap on lump sum contributions that were called undeducted, now called non-concessional, so change all the terminology as well. And you'll remember this as well as I do. On the night of the budget, which was the 9th of May off the top of my head, they said, today is the last day at 7:30 that you are allowed to make a lump sum contribution over $150,000 a year. You may no longer do that and we will consider the possibility of allowing you to do 3 years bring forward. And that was very likely to be implemented because they had a majority in the House of Reps and the Senate. So I remember going, oh God, we've got so many clients and people we work with who have checks that haven't cleared yet, who are suddenly captured by this $1 million check, what do we do? And then that was a scenario where they had to go back and say, all right, fine, we'll change it. And that was when we had the $1 million opportunity where people could contribute up to $1 million and they gave people an extra 13 months to do that. Yes. But it was a really good example of when the policy is announced, even when government has all of their ducks lined up, but had not considered some of the unintended consequences, change the policy, the legislation when it's implemented looks somewhat different. And initial panic wasn't quite as necessary.
As you mentioned right at the beginning, there is an equity issue to some extent, which politicians do are mindful of. And while they will often announce policies where they haven't had broad consultation with the public at least, they're very sensitive to that response from the public in where there's an appropriate response and will often change the legislation. So even where they don't have to deal with the crossbenches and those sort of things in the Senate, if they have that majority, that's still the case. But yes, you're quite right. And I think, again, I'm not sure what the state of the Senate will look like after the next election. I don't, obviously no one does, but on the assumption, as you said, that for a long time now we've had crossbenches, which have eventually essentially had the balance of the vote in the Senate. I wouldn't expect that it's likely to change significantly. And so it will shape any legislation that the Labor Party would introduce, should, even though they won the election, assuming that they do, that's the first step. Secondly, they're clearly taking this to the election as a policy. So they would feel they had a mandate to introduce this legislation.
Yeah, voters have had an opportunity to give their view on it. And also any crossbenchers and anybody else would have plenty of time to formulate a view.
Yes, yeah. Indeed as well. So, but that still leaves, as you say, it open for there to be changes and sometimes significant changes to the policy in order to get it through the parliamentary process. So yes, the point is, I think, that unlike the trustees that I spoke to earlier on this year, there is no point to panic at this stage. There's very much a case of there is a long road ahead, and there is some time before these policies will become law, and there will be an introductory date. I think it's very much a be aware of it, but don't panic quite so much at the moment yet.
So one question I have had is, how do the proposals work for large public offer funds and also So we're thinking about self-managed super funds in particular, mm-hmm. where if they are in pension phase, 100% of the fund is in pension phase. We know that more than half of all assets in the SMSF sector support a pension. It may have dropped a bit since the 1.6 was introduced.
It has quite a lot, actually. But okay. Yeah.
You know
but
these numbers better than
I do. No, it is obviously a significant drop because there were some very large self-managed super funds fully in pension phase, and that's no longer the case. So quite a substantial amount of capital has been moved back into accumulation phase or moved out of the superannuation system altogether as a result of the 1 July 17 changes to limit the amount of capital you can have supporting pension liabilities, be it self-managed fund or large industry fund or corporate funds, whatever. Yeah.
That actually is quite an interesting point to make as it relates to the franking credit changes, by the way. So as I remember this well with the 2007 changes for the age pension as well. They give you 3 years of costings in the budget. So in the federal budget, they do 3 years of costing. They tend not to tell you what it's going to cost years on. And at the moment, the franking credit rebates cost $5 billion a year. So the original estimates were, less than 10% of that. And so this is what happens. People go, this seems like a really good idea. And then later on, they realize it's vastly more expensive than they thought it was going to be. Yeah. And there is some review, perhaps. Yeah. And the 1 July change is a really good example of that. We're really happy for everyone to have tax-free super over the age of 60 and tax-free pensions until we realised there were a handful of self-managed super funds with $100 million in them. And
100% in pension phase.
100% in pension phase and, could have paid tax to support a small country.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
And so it changed the system there. So for those large public offer funds, mm-hmm. and for SMSFs where they are both in accumulation and pension phase, or just in accumulation phase, how would they be affected if this does come in?
Yeah, so the important thing to remember with the large funds is the assumption always is that they have a mix, they all have a mix of people in accumulation phase and people in pension phase in the same fund. Mm. That's not necessarily the case for a start. Mm-hmm. And some funds have been set up whereby the accumulators sit in one fund and the pensioners sit in a separate fund.
Yeah, they're quarantined from each other.
Yeah, they are quarantined from each other because they're physically in separate funds, which are separate taxpayers.
Oh.
So if a particular fund, a large corporate fund or industry fund, and I'm not thinking about anyone in particular here, but if they were set up that way, then the pension fund, which is 100%, is in exactly the same position as the self-managed super fund, where the self-managed super fund is 100% in pension phase because it, as a taxpayer, has no tax liability because everyone's in pension phase, but is invested in Australian shares and will receive franking credits, which it can't use under this new proposal either, and will not get a refund of them either, if they are set up that way. So they are in that position. So it's important to identify first how the fund, large or small, is set up. So the size is not relevant in that sense, is how they are as a taxpayer.
Structure.
The structure and the type of taxpayer they are, which is important to keep in mind. And I think that even where you have a mix of accumulators and pensioners in the same fund, the franking credit is a 30% tax credit, and the tax liability for super funds, large or small, is 15. So there is this excess franking credit over and above, yes, a certain amount, that the franking credit is taxable at 15%, even though you have no income, so some of the tax, the credit is used up to offset the tax liability on the dividend. Mm. But there's always an excess, and sometimes even where you have accumulators in the fund, there is still an excess, even after you've wiped out full tax liability of the fund as well. So in that sense, even where you have a mix of accumulators and pensioners, it will vary from fund to fund as to how that might play out from a tax point of view, depending upon the level, the proportionate size of accumulators to pensioners, the amount of income that's being generated on accumulation accounts compared to pension accounts. Because large or small, a super fund is a single taxpayer.
Yeah.
Each one of the members are not individual taxpayers in this context. The fund as a whole is a taxpayer. And so it's the broad tax liability of the whole fund which determines whether in fact they end up with an excess or not. And it has been interesting that it has been reported in the press that some of those larger funds are actually saying, looking back on our last few years' tax returns, actually
we've had excess
franking credits, even though we might have thousands of members and we wouldn't have expected to. In fact, we have actually had a refund of franking credits in that scenario. So Yeah, so while it has been suggested that he was targeting self-managed super funds in particular, I think
there may be some other taxpayers who are much more adversely affected.
The bigger funds as well need to have a look at their particular circumstances and their mix of members and those in accumulation and pension phase as well, because they could be affected by this change also. But having said that, probably the largest group of funds, because probably there are more of them than anyone else, you know, 700,000 of them. So a lot of self-managed super funds are impacted by that. As you pointed out, a large proportion of funds by number have at least one member in pension phase.
Yeah.
And so could be adversely affected by this particular situation if that pension account balance represents a large proportion of the fund's assets, for example.
Something we haven't discussed, but it's worth thinking about. So we know that on average, averages are always interesting, but on average, SMSFs are around 40% invested in Australian equities, sort of on average. So by the time you add in hybrids and other bits and pieces, sort of 40-ish percent, 30 to 40. But around sort of 25 to 30% in cash. And then you've got to consider all the other assets as well. So it's worth noting that franking credits, you're not applying it to the entire income base of the fund. It's only obviously to those shares paying dividends on income where there was tax paid in Australian dollars and all that sort of stuff. Yep. So you think about those companies with very high offshore earnings, for example, and they don't pay out substantial franking credits or substantial yields in many cases. Yep. CSL's a really good example of that. Yep. Top three Australian company now, given where things are going. So it's worth noting that the structure of your portfolio and your asset allocation is material in this situation. If you are heavily overweight Australian equities and heavily overweight Australian equities that pay fully franked dividends, this is going to be much more relevant to you than if you have a widely diversified portfolio, and particularly if you're getting income from a variety of sources.
And some of that's not in pension phase as well, of course.
Yeah, and so then there is this issue of whether or not you're in pension phase in its entirety, or whether it's...
Yeah, so the response to a change like this could be a change in asset allocation by trustees or members of trustees, because remember too, the interesting thing for self-managed super fund members is that member direction, investment direction is possible right down to what share I want to invest in.
Yeah.
So unlike the bigger funds that allow you to perhaps have a conservative choice of portfolio or a high growth or something in between, balanced or whatever, but the trustees still choose what the underlying investments are. Mm. For self-managed super funds, they can actually say, no, I want that particular share in that particular company, or I want this particular term deposit, or I want this particular whatever. And so they can be far more have far more influence on the actual underlying investments that they choose. Even though they might want to invest their money differently to other members of the fund as well, they're still allowed to do that. So it's not even that it has to be a group decision of all members in a self-managed fund. Individual members can choose to invest their share of the fund differently to other members of the fund as well. So so within a self-managed super fund, different members may even respond differently to this in terms of what they feel is reasonable. And it may well be that a lot of people feel that loss of a franking credit, while inconvenient and impacts cash flow, nevertheless, is not a reason to change out a particular otherwise high yielding sort of stocks, which were even better when you got a refund of franking credits, but it's still pretty good even without that franking credit, for example. Others might feel that, well, no, I rather than have a wasted franking credit, I want to change my asset allocation. I want to add new members to the fund who are in accumulation phase. And that was one of the stated purposes of the proposed increase of the number of maximum number of members in a self-managed superannuation fund.
Oh, interesting, was it? Okay.
Was to allow perhaps more members, younger members in accumulation phase, to be added to a self-managed superannuation fund to then have their tax liability offset by franking credits, which are being generated by people who might be in pension phase in the same fund.
Stupid question.
As an example.
Because I recall that policy being announced. Has that been legislated yet?
No.
Okay, good example of policy not yet legislated, because I mean that was 6 months ago we were having a conversation
about that. Yeah, yeah.
So that policy is still...
It was announced in the last budget.
Yeah, there you go.
And it still hasn't made it into
Is there any draft legislation?
Good question. I was trying to remember whether there isn't. We have so much outstanding legislation in this area at the moment, some of which has been around for longer than 12 months and is in Parliament but hasn't made it through the parliamentary process. And I can't recall off the top of my head whether, in fact, I don't believe we have that legislation even in draft form.
Okay. So that is worth noting, though, right? So if that does get legislated, and was there any opposition to it?
Broadly, I don't think so.
Everyone's
I think
fine. So it should go through pretty easily.
It's something
even when they bring it to the parliament.
Yeah, it's something that the industry has been asking for a long time, and while a maximum number of 4 to a maximum number of 6 is not a big jump, it's still an improvement on where we were, and it has limited appeal, I guess, in the sense that 85% of self-managed super funds have 2 members.
Yeah. It's not everybody who's thinking about it.
Another 10% have 1 member, so it only leaves 5% that actually have 3 or 4 members. So there's a small group of people who might be interested in doing this, even if there was a change in policy around franking credits. I suspect we're not going to see a rush of people trying to add their children to their self-managed superannuation fund.
That brings a whole lot of other risks, right?
It does, yeah. Yes, indeed, indeed. The biggest risk of all, they get to find out how much money you've got.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can imagine some parents, my own included, would not be thrilled with that at all.
No.
That's quite funny. So the strategies then, let's just say this does become law, it comes into effect, the strategies that people could contemplate. One is bringing in other members in accumulation phase.
And that's probably the most effective one, I guess, in a way. Effective use of franking credits would otherwise be lost.
Yeah.
Because you're otherwise, you haven't changed your investment portfolio. And you're able to benefit. It is possible even for the other people in accumulation phase to internally compensate the pensioners for the loss of the franking credits that they use to offset their tax liability.
Yeah.
There is an acceptable argument to say that that might even be possible. So that might be the most appropriate, probably the best response that I can think of. But there are others, as you say.
So one thing I saw a little bit of, I certainly got a lot of questions about, was with the introduction of the $1.6 million cap, was people who were over the cap attempting to segregate their pension assets in an SMSF, and then putting their accumulation assets, so they're over the 1.6, say they've got $2 million. They'd take the $400 that was in excess of their cap, that had to be kept in accumulation phase or withdrawn from the system. They wouldn't withdraw it from the system. They'd roll it into a public offer fund, for example. The odd person started a second SMSF, which is different strategy entirely. In that scenario, there may be real merit in actually bringing that back to the single fund, because your accumulation fund can then sop up some of the franking credits.
Yes, well, that's right. That's certainly the case. Certainly,
not to say that's definitely the right strategy, but it's worth contemplating.
Well, the fact that you have to have that money sitting in accumulation phase means that then that's an effective use of the franking credits are being generated by the fund as a whole. And so you're not artificially creating more income for the sake of it, for the sake of using the franking credits. The law requires you to construct your pension accumulation accounts this way. So, so yes, retaining that money inside the superannuation system, should this be brought in, is something that people should consider. A lot of discussion has been around, well, should that money even stay in superannuation? And if you were to invest it outside superannuation, given your marginal rates of tax, you might pay less than 15% tax on the income that's being earned on that income. So maybe taking it out would be a good response to the 1 July 17 changes. People might now be thinking about, maybe I should leave it in there after all, should this change come through. Yes, and the other thing is that while I don't necessarily agree with the let's move our nominated Australian share account to a bigger superannuation fund, so we get effectively the refund of franking credits, or we get to those franking credits get to be utilised inside the fund. That could be an example where your pension account remaining inside your super fund, if that's what you decide to do, has limited or no Australian shares in it.
Yeah, okay.
And then your
asset allocations are different.
And so and if it's possible in the larger fund, and see, it may not be possible, but if you can set it up so it's possible, you can choose how you invest your money. You invest in the larger fund, that could be predominantly your Australian share exposure there, where the franking credits are effectively part of the return that the fund generates as a whole, because it's able to use up effectively those franking credits in its broader tax liability. Again, if there are different scenarios where it might be artificial and you're really not improving your situation. No, you might be using your franking credits, but not actually improving your overall return.
Your overall return, yes. You're creating a lot of complexity and not necessarily...
Yes, achieving anything.
Achieving much. I think also it is a really good opportunity, and I do mean this in all sincerity, to look at your portfolio and go, do I believe these stocks are worth holding? Or am I frankly just, no pun intended, enjoying a fantastic grossed up dividend without a great deal of confidence in the longer term prospects of this company? And it is a bit of a double-edged sword. You know, you can see scenarios where clearly senior executives have focused on ensuring they can pay very high, fully franked yields to investors, and it's hard to see what other strategy exactly is going on with the company. You know, so it's a good opportunity to have a look at a very deep level at the companies that you are invested in and go, is that really where I want to be? Or have I just been attracted by the yield? And the refund of franking credits being a critical component of that yield for many people. Yep. Is that what's been driving my investing behaviour, or is it something more?
Yeah, and I think to a large extent, with Australian retirees, it has. You know, many, whether they're investing inside super or outside super, have an investment mindset that they have a certain amount of money invested in the Australian share market that gives them, on average, a yield of a particular amount each year that they live off. They don't contemplate the concept of ever selling their shares. So whether the market goes up or down
is irrelevant
to some extent for them, because all they're worried about is the level of dividend they receive. And they're very disciplined. They just live off the dividend, whatever their portfolio yields. And that's the way they live going forward. So clearly, if they have that mindset, then to lose a big chunk of their yield with this refund could cause them to change that. Whether they're in super or outside super. So if you're in that type of scenario, then yes, you may well respond and question whether holding a very large proportion of your wealth in a very small share market on a global scale.
And a narrow range of sectors, frankly.
And a narrow range of sectors.
We've talked about a lot of times on this podcast. People are very concentrated in their portfolios in Australia, and it's clearly driven by the legislative arrangements that support that.
Well, I think one of the things that people always say about investing in the share market is invest in companies you understand the business of. And so there's a familiarity with Australian companies and businesses, which is perhaps not there for some of the international stocks that they might otherwise be thinking about investing in. But, you know, that's changing, obviously. Everyone knows who Apple is.
Well, that's true. We all know Apple better than we know pretty much anything else.
Look
at it 2,700 times a day.
That's exactly right. Yes. So that could be changing as well in terms of familiarity. And so it's a good opportunity for people to think about their asset allocation.
Any recommendations for people who are genuinely concerned about this? You've talked about a lot of strategies people could contemplate, and I think you've done a fabulous job of helping people think through. Yeah, there's actually quite a few different options for you, which may resolve the issue at hand, and may ensure that your overall scenario doesn't change dramatically. But you do need to work out whether the cost and the implications of those changes are worthwhile. Any recommendations for people who are genuinely worried about it now?
Yes, I think the important one is that we've already said is that this is not law yet. Don't panic yet. We don't even know what the rules are going to end up looking like at this point in time.
And there are too many rules that have ended up looking completely different to what the original proposal was.
Yeah. Indeed. So I think the idea is to be mindful of it. By all means, start looking at your portfolio and the asset mix now, if that's not a bad thing to do anyway. But don't necessarily make wholesale changes until we have a better picture of exactly what it is that we're facing, I think, going forward. Like the trustees we spoke to when this was first announced, to perhaps jump too quickly, has some benefits. The market in March last year didn't respond to this type of announcement significantly in terms of values. One could imagine a scenario where if there was a wholesale disposal of exposure to Australian shares by a large group of taxpayers, that could have an impact on the Australian market, and perhaps you don't want to be at the end of that. You'd like to be at the beginning of that rather than the
end. It's worth noting as well, it will be a handful of big names that will suffer the most. Yeah, you could pretty much write down a list right now and know which shares would be most dramatically impacted if this change were to occur and people were to respond dramatically to the change.
And that's a big if as well. I mean, we've spoken about a number of different scenarios that people have taken, and not all of those are the let's dump our Australian shares. Either. So it really depends on how investors respond as well as to whether that's a likely scenario or not as well. So the point is, you know, we could have any number of scenarios play out. And you're better than me if you can pick which one it's going to be, because I certainly couldn't tell you which one it's likely to be, even if we do get the legislation as announced through Parliament in its current form. So really the idea is to just be aware of the changes as they occur, if they do occur, listen to the commentary, keep yourself up to date in terms of the various views and where it's all going to, and make some informed decisions, I think, is the important thing, rather than panic decisions.
Peter, you keep SMSF trustees informed, to your term, with sensational information. So the SMSF Association produces very high quality, well-researched, highly valid information. Where can people go to keep up to date with that?
Yeah, we, four trustees, have our Trustee Knowledge Centre, which is just an online service where we just keep a lot of articles, a lot of webinars and videos of interest to trustees of superannuation funds. We do predominantly have them as more technical information, so it's more around trustee responsibilities and what they need to know. There are some, for those who are interested in products and so on, and for investment purposes, there is some information about those, but predominantly the information is around the sort of things as trustees they need to do to make sure their fund is run properly, they stay on the right side of the regulator and their auditor, and they make informed decisions around their obligations as trustees. So they're most welcome to look at the SMSF Association website and look at the Trustee Knowledge Centre as part of that. It is still there. We are about to launch a new discrete Trustee Knowledge Centre website, but that hasn't happened yet. So if you're interested in the meantime, then you can go through the association website to the Trustee Knowledge Centre.
Fantastic. The other one that's worth noting is the ATO actually has very good quality information.
They do indeed have excellent material now on trustee responsibilities and what trustees need to do as well.
Yeah, and they do videos and all sorts of stuff, and they have transcripts of all the videos and stuff. Yep. They do a great job. And worth noting, they would never put up anything that wasn't yet law. So if you're confused about whether or not it's currently law, the ATO website will not have it up there if it's not law yet.
No, indeed. And that's an important point to make, that they administer the law as it is, not as it might be in the future. And so they're very clear about that and what they can put on their website and publish, indeed.
Beautiful. Peter from the SMSF Association, thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure. It was great.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful for you in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you. This podcast in particular was definitely created from feedback and questions we've been receiving. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.